I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. The view we have of Hearst has been due largely to Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, and perhaps incorrectly, as we read the new book from Kenneth White. In The Uncrowned King, The Sensational Rise of William Randolph Hearst, we see a reinterpretation of one of the legendary newspaper barons of all time. We also have a remarkable insight into Hearst's times, the people who were on the scene with him, who rivaled for newspaper audiences, and of course the politics and culture of the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. Kenneth White is the publisher and editor-in-chief of Maclean's, and was the editor of Saturday Night before becoming the founding editor of the National Post. Published by Random House, this is his first book. It is a tremendous book, wonderfully written, one that's difficult to put down and endlessly fascinating. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Ken White. Good morning, Mr. White.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Has a book been published in the United States?
No, it's in bookstores in the U.S. in a couple of weeks, but the official publication is in January in the U.S.
Let's talk about Citizen Kane. What about the film, or what in the film is wrong about Hearst?
Well, pretty much all of it's wrong about Hearst. Charles Foster Kane, the subject of the movie, is a fictional character, and over the years, people have believed that he was a stand-in for William Randolph Hearst, that it was effectively Hearst's biography. But when you look at their lives and their characters, there really isn't that much similarity. And Orson Welles, who made the film, about 10, 12 years after it was made, did admit that really the character Kane bore little resemblance to Hearst, that they were different people altogether. And some people have even suggested that in the end, the character of Kane wound up resembling Orson Welles more than it did Randolph Hearst, because it's a story, the movie, about a young a boy wonder of the newspaper business who ends up alone and broken and forlorn, and that was more Orson Welles' story, who started off as a boy wonder in the world of theater and movies and ended up unproductive and alone and disappointed. Hearst himself was certainly a boy wonder of the newspaper world when he started off, but he never really slowed down. He continued to expand. He had some ups and downs, but he continued to be productive his whole life. And the character of Kane, which was you know, he starts off okay, but he gets increasingly nasty and isolated and egocentric. I didn't find that that resembled Hearst at all. I found him a much more sympathetic figure than that.
Well, what about the other biographies? And you cite them in your book. I guess the most recent one was The Chief, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did they say about Hearst?
Well, the one main thing that I was arguing with is that all of the biographers and most of the journalism histories have seen Hearst as a failure in his chosen professor. And say whatever else you will about Hearst, there's no question that he spent most of his life as a newspaper man and a newspaper owner. That was his overwhelming preoccupation throughout his 80-some years. He did own radio stations, and he did own a movie studio, and he did build a lot of magnificent buildings like San Simeon Castle in California. But newspapers were nearest and dearest to his heart, and is what he put most of his effort and most of his fortune into. He is widely considered to have been a failure as a newspaper man. I looked back at this particular period when he was starting out, when he came from San Francisco to New York City in 1895, and he was at the time unknown and unheralded, and in 3 years he established himself as the leading publisher in North America. I talk about how he did that, and my view is that he succeeded because he put out actually a very good newspaper at the time, and that it was actually recognized as being a very good newspaper at the time, and so that the foundation of his fortune is actually built on a certain kind of journalistic excellence rather than on producing an illegitimate lowbrow paper that catered to the lowest common denominator and made money but was otherwise entirely without merit. And that, I think, is largely the view of him in other treatments.
I guess that's the one thing that struck me, that how serious he was about journalism. Did making a profit, did that factor? I mean, it must have.
Yeah, he wanted to make money, because without making money, he couldn't expand and grow and own more newspapers and have more influence. But he was, on the whole, pretty cavalier about money, in part because he had a family fortune behind him, but also because it was just his temperament. He was interested in making newspapers and in building newspapers, and far less in squeezing another nickel out of the operation to add to his personal fortune.
The one thing that really interested me in reading this book was how interesting you made the Gilded Age seem. And
it was interesting. I didn't do that. It was interesting all on its own.
There's some things I want to ask you. What is the Tenderloin?
The Tenderloin was a district in New York. Action was. It had all the clubs and gambling joints and opium dens and houses of ill repute. And it was running along Broadway. It was sort of the vice capital of New York City, and chroniclers of vice in New York have said that there was never probably any time in New York except in this period in the Gilded Age where one neighborhood was home to so much vice and corruption and criminality. It set New York's all-time records for those things, the Tenderloin in the Gilded Age.
And Park Row, that's where all the newspapers were, right?
Yeah, Park Row, also known as Newspaper Row, was a strip of buildings alongside City Hall and City Hall Park in New York. And at the time, it was comparable to Wall Street is today in a way, in that it was a sort of geographic center of the most vital part of the local economy. It had the biggest buildings and the biggest, new, richest operations, which newspapers were at the time. And that's not an unusual thing in North America. You go across a lot of these cities, and the biggest buildings and the greatest fortunes at the beginning of the 20th century were in publishing. In fact, in Vancouver, the original Sun Building, which I think was built in 1910, was at the time the tallest building in the British Empire, it was again a tribute to the financial might and the great value of newspapers at the time.
One of the inhabitants of Park Row was Hearst's main competitor, Joseph Pulitzer. One of the things that that caught me early on when you were discussing Pulitzer and his, I guess he got married. Some guy went with him on his honeymoon. And then you discuss this later in the book. You mentioned Pulitzer's sexuality.
Well, I'm glad that you noticed that, because nobody else has asked me about it. But he was an odd duck, Pulitzer. He did have a very close relationship with I think his name was John McCullough, an actor, and he took the guy along on his honeymoon with Mrs. Pulitzer, which was a bit unusual, to say the least. And then all through his later years, even though he had a family and he fathered a number of children, and his relationships with Mrs. Pulitzer were often, as far as you can tell from his letters, warm and cordial, lived apart from her and the family for most of the year, and traveled in the company of male secretaries, many of whom were young and single and would be lifelong bachelors. And I don't have any hard evidence, any real evidence to say that his sexuality was unusual. I just found it curious that people are always writing about Hearst and Hearst's relationships and intimate relationships, and there's been very little curiosity about Pulitzer's when in many ways he lived the more unconventional lifestyle.
What also astonished me about reading about the Times was that there were so many newspapers in New York. They sold for a penny, most of the papers. I know the Hearst paper did, and the Pulitzer papers did.
Most of them were actually 2-3 cents, but Hearst and Pulitzer did sell for a penny, and they were undercutting the market a bit.
Was that a lot of money then?
Yeah, it was. It's not easy to translate it. You can't just, you know, pull out the tables and look at the inflation rates and say that it was, you know, 2 or 3 cents then is equal to, I don't know, 50 cents or a dollar now, because at the time, the purchasing power of a dollar was a lot different than it is now. There was no income tax. But it was a substantial sum of money. But New York was just becoming affluent enough, and the middle classes were becoming affluent enough to be able to spend pennies and nickels and dimes on newspapers and all the new public entertainments that were coming up, like Broadway shows and Coney Island fairs and those sorts of things.
Could we say that the people buying the papers, that they were more literate, or at least more informed, perhaps?
I think there's no doubt that it was a more literate culture than ours. The absolute literacy rate might not have been quite as high, but the complexity of the language and even the mass market newspapers, the broadest circulating papers like Hearst and Pulitzer's with 500,000 to 1 million circulation, the complexity of the language, sophistication of the writing was far beyond what you'd see in most newspapers today.
You talked about the quality of papers, and it must have been fun to look back and read all those newspapers. This idea, though, of yellow journalism, sensationalism, mm-hmm. was very much a part of the times.
And there's some huge misconceptions around the idea of yellow journalism, and this was one of the things that surprised me in writing the book. You know, I think we think of yellow journalism as being
taboo.
Lowbrow sensationalist journalism and disregard for the truth and anything to sell a paper. And that was, in some respects, how the phrase was first used. Hearst's competitors threw that phrase at him as an insult. They were small circulation, elite, conservative newspapers that were losing ground to Hearst and to Pulitzer as they fashioned this new form of popular mass market journalism. They couldn't compete with Hearst when it came to hiring the best talent and doing the most enterprising journalism, so they wrapped themselves in a cloak of goodness and righteousness and said that they were respectable papers trying to bring the mob up to their level, whereas Hearst and Pulitzer were pandering to the people at their own level. They were in the sewer with the common man, and that paternalism and condescension of the elite papers towards the more democratic papers is where the phrase yellow journalism came from, and I think the notion that you that they were trying to promote that somehow illegitimate to do a newspaper that talks to the man in the street in his own values in his own language itself kind of offensive, and if people understood where the phrase yellow journalism came from, I don't think they'd be throwing it around so freely.
And having read those newspapers, looking back at them, I guess you did them before you wrote the book even, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from them that was essential for you in that newspaper war that you were part of 10 years ago?
There wasn't anything in Hearst's business model or anything that you could just pick up and apply. back, because it was a different time, and journalistic values were different. But there were some things that I found helpful. One was just their orientation towards their readers. I mean, Hearst, as an editor at this point in his life, was overwhelmingly preoccupied with understanding his readers and what interests them and what moves them. And every decision he made about story choices and headline choices and illustration choices were aimed at communicating directly with his readers and engaging his readers. Now, since that time, newspapers have changed a lot, and they get a lot more of their revenue from advertising than they do from readers, and I think they've taken their readers for granted, and they, we tend to edit less with a concern to communicate directly with the man in the street, and tend to make story choices more about what interests us or what interests our peers or what we think people should read about, and we spend much less time as editors thinking about what they're really interested in, what their priorities and values are. So that fundamental orientation, I think Hearst was healthier than what we have today, and so I tried to learn from that. And then you just pick up a lot of story ideas and steal a lot of little tactical things like approaches to illustration and headlining and features, and some of it you can pick up directly and try. There was one thing Hearst did after a big trial, a very exciting trial in New York that ended up being effectively declared a mistrial. There was no verdict. Hearst was dissatisfied with that, and he convened his own jury had it pronounce on the case. It was of no weight at all, but it was really interesting to read what, you know, this jury of peers that he assembled had to say about it. When I was at the Post, there was a period in time when Kretchen was prime minister, the parliament wasn't sitting enough. Kretchen liked to meet with parliament as little as possible, and we thought there were a lot of issues that should be discussed that weren't being discussed, and we were kind of annoyed that parliament wasn't sitting, so we convened our own parliament and managed to get members, individual MPs from all the parties, to join in the debate, which we kept going for a week or two on what we considered to be the important issues of the day. So tactical things like that you could pick up. But it's not just Hearst paper. I do that all the time as an editor. I did it before when I was in magazines, because most of the best stuff in our industry, I think, has already been done. We have such a rich history. There's hardly anything you can think of now that hasn't been thought of before and done somewhere better. So it's always easier to go back and plunder than to dream up new things yourself.
I'm sure on this book tour, many people have been asking you about comparing Hearst to Conrad Black, who you worked with.
It comes up from time to time.
Yeah, does that annoy you?
No, not at all. I mean, I worked with Conrad, he's a part of my life and part of my career, and I fully expected people to raise it.
Is a comparison apt?
I don't think there's really that much comparison, except they were both rich guys who owned newspapers. Maybe there's you can also argue that both of them were feared and controversial figures in their time, in their day. But they were very, very, very different people, very different operators. I mean, Hearst could actually go in and run a newsroom, and did, and ran the newsroom as well as anyone ever has. Conrad was more removed from his operations than that. He's very smart about newspapers, but he wasn't, in his bones a practicing newspaper man like Hearst was. And also, Hearst, when things got bad, Hearst did everything he could to hang on to his newspapers. He never let go of them. They meant more to him than money. Conrad, when he felt it was financially necessary, could part willingly with his newspapers. I think he was a businessman who loved newspapers. So Hearst was a newspaper man who was in business.
What about Rupert Murdoch?
I think that there's some similarities between Hearst and Murdoch, mostly because both of them have a sort of a contempt for elite opinion and an unusual ability to communicate with everyday folk. You know, the success of the Fox broadcasting under Murdoch, you know, shows like The Simpsons and so on, I think has been remarkable. Hearst had a lot of that same sort of popular touch. You know, their politics were very different. Murdoch's seen as a conservative force. Now Hearst, in his day, especially when I'm writing about him, was radically progressive. So they were very different that way.
There's the famous line attributed to Hearst regarding his involvement in the Spanish-American War. He told one of his reporters or one of his illustrators that you furnish the pictures and I'll furnish the war.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
He might have written something similar to that, though the Telegraph has never been found. But it almost certainly didn't mean what whatever he wrote. It almost certainly doesn't mean what people think it means. He wasn't saying to the guy, wait around in Cuba for a few weeks while I convince the U.S. to go into war against Spain over Cuba. That would have been, at the time, a ridiculous proposition, and Hearst was nothing if not shrewd about what was possible and what wasn't in terms of influencing the government. The interesting thing about the whole Cuba situation for me was that Hearst really did have a purpose there. I read, like a lot of people, that Hearst wanted a war with Spain just to sell newspapers, that it was a cynical endeavor. And I went into this project thinking that was the case, but then when you actually see what he did in his newspaper, he had been campaigning for 3 years on behalf of the Cuban people who were fighting for their liberty from Spain, and he believed in their cause philosophically. He believed in their right to self-determination and that people should be free from their colonial masters. And secondarily, he believed that Spain was putting down the rebellion in Cuba in an inhumane manner, and he was right. Tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of civilians were being moved into reconcentration camps, as they were called at the time, effectively concentration camps, and they were dying in droves of starvation and disease. And so it was a humanitarian cause as well as a principled cause for Hearst.
One of the bios that your publisher sent over with the book, the bio, I guess, is humorously written, mentions that you, when you edited the Alberta Report Saturday night in the Post, you posted losses throughout. How are you doing with McLean's?
Well, we are doing quite well. We've had a nice run over the last 4 years. It's been healthily profitable every year. The business has been growing, especially its readership and its circulation and its newsstand sales. So, knock on wood, so far we're doing quite well.
And do you still enjoy doing it?
Yeah, I love it. You know, I wasn't sure after I left the Post whether I'd ever come back to the business because it was such a unique and exciting experience. I didn't really think that anything else could match it, but McLean's has been a lot of fun. We work with some really good people, so I've been enjoying myself.
Here's a bit unsolicited, of course. One of my favorite, I love Wells and I love Coyne. I like that Mitchell Raphael column that's in the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I really like Jamie Wineman.
Oh, I'm glad you noticed him. You know, he was our discovery, absolutely. He was an obscure blogger before we hired him at McLean's, and I think he's an absolutely brilliant arts writer and keeps getting better all the time. He's only been with us for a year or two, but he's got an incredibly bright future. He's a very talented young man.
Would you consider writing other books?
Yeah. As soon as I get done flogging this one, I'm going to pick something else up. I'm not sure what.
Well, would you write about Hearst again? Would you finish the life, I guess?
I'm not really that interested in the rest of his life. I suppose No, I'd rather write about something else. There are a lot of other interesting people, a lot of other interesting events. So the fun in these things is exploring and learning new things. And I guess if I could find a way to rediscover some other part of Hearst's career or times, then I might. But it's not apparent to me right now how to do that.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Ken, and congratulations on this book.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
It is a remarkable book. I was reading a part of the book which discusses the 1896 election during the last during the past presidential campaign. It was fascinating.
There are a lot of echoes between the two campaigns.
There are, yeah. Continued good luck with it. The book is called The Uncrowned King, The Sensational Rise of William Randolph Hearst, published by Random House, $35. Ken White is the publisher and editor of Maclean's. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plata.